How's she doing?
Not great. But this is just between us, okay?
Everybody, this is Again With This, Melrose Place. Today's episode is Season 3, Episode 24, To Live and Die in Malibu. And now, here are your hosts, Tara Ariano and Sarah DiBate.
We have so much to get through. This is not the energy we need from you on record number 1 of 5.
I don't hate it.
This isn't supposed to be miserable.
I feel like there's a George of the Jungle thing that's about to happen, and we're going to live a life that's free. Hi, Tara and Dave.
Hi, Sarah.
So very, very quickly before Dave goes into the squeef spiral and can't be retrieved. Again with this, episode 46 for our Patreon supporters will be dropping May 7th. We will be discussing YM, that's Young Miss, I guess.
I guess by this point it was Young and Modern.
Oh, very good. September 1991's issue, we will be discussing the magazine's cover story on the, quote, close-knit, LOL, Beverly Hills 90210 cast, the scrapey tyranny of Buff Puff products, Claudia's abusive boyfriend in the letters section, and so much more. Join us at patreon.com/againwiththis for mom jeans, supermodels, et al.
Visual aids.
Oh, yes. Big time. And now a little more site business. We are told we should be pronouncing the name of the actor who plays Jess, Dan Cortez.
I believe that is what I said, just for the record, because I love to be right, but proceed.
I am absolutely sure that that is not what I said. I said Cortez.
Fun fact, the reason why Melrose Place had so many more seasons after this is because Dan Cortez burned his boats when the Melrose Place cast came ashore, and they had no way to get back to their homeland.
It's a nice reference, Dave. Sarah.
I was going to go with the Cortez the Killer thing in honor of Neil Young, Canadian. Any hoodle, we'll pronounce it correctly henceforth, I hope. And speaking of, let's start doing so with our B-plot.
Oh,
take it away, Tara.
Let's do our B-plot. Look out, L.A. Here comes Jess. We open with beautiful old Melrose Place B-roll. Sometimes I just find it so soothing. And this is sometimes with B-roll, as Sarah loves to note, when it's super duper old. Sometimes it's super duper old. This is clearly 90s Melrose B-roll. You can tell from the stores. And you can see some of that in the visual aids. Also, some of the B-roll, which I didn't clip, is definitely stuff we've seen before. Like, here's someone delivering a pile of bound up newspapers. Here's someone opening umbrellas on the sidewalk cafe or whatever. Those
Here's Kid Seiko Extra in his Zubaz. I wish one day he's going to show up and I'll be like, hey, buddy.
Yes. Anyway, this dumps us out at Shooters, where Jess soon enters and looks around impressed. And Sydney comes out from the back, politely tells him when they open, but he says he's looking for Jake. She reports Jake is not in yet, what with his mother's funeral. So Jess catches up the new viewers by saying he knows all about that since he's, you know, Jake's brother. And Sydney is thrilled to meet him and also just announces, despite being pretty tight with Jake, that he has never mentioned Jess, which, like, I mean, that's also to catch up the new viewers, but also rude. Like,
well, yeah, way to put yourself on blast, Jake on blast, the writers on blast. Like, I just feel like that maybe wasn't necessary, but I guess it's also planting the seeds for some antagonism, as we'll see.
Sure. So she then giddily introduces herself and then stares at Jess as though deciding whether he will do for her purposes as a store brand Jake. But he says he'll come back later, adding that Jake doesn't know he's in town, so she shouldn't say that she saw him. But Sydney loves surprises and would be happy to show Jess where Jake lives, which is how Sydney ends up delivering Jess to Jake's door. Jake does not look thrilled to see him, but lets him in. And then Sydney tries to walk in with Jess, but Jake is like, pushes her out.
Slams the door in her face.
Sydney Not so much with the hints and picking up of same, but
no.
Jess offers to leave if Jake thinks this is bad timing or whatever, but Jake says, you know, well, you just got here. Like, I can't really say yes, leave.
But the meter's running right. Comment is implied strongly.
But apparently feeling encouraged, Jess goes on, clip two.
You know, everything's kind of turned to dust now that Mom's gone. I mean, I used to bitch all the time. Well, she was a handful, you know, with her drinking and her bed hopping, but at least it gave me something to do. Not that I enjoyed being saddled with all the responsibility.
Look, I know it was rough on you.
Well, it's not like I'm blaming you exactly. It's just, I'm scared. I am so much like her. I get some wild idea in my head. Next thing I know, I'm out of control. Jake, I don't like what I've become. You're the only family I got. I hoped, maybe, you could help me turn my life around. Make something of myself, the way you did.
Hey, man, I'm just, you know, working stiff.
Bull. I was down at Shooters. You own something, man. It's yours. I got nothing.
So did you come all the way down here to lay a guilt trip on me?
You are so full of yourself. I thought we finally connected the other day. My mistake.
I mean, go ahead.
Well, just the, like, don't make me end up like our mom. Like, what are you even talking about? It's like so strange.
The characterization of their mom, who, reminder, we did meet her, but like the way she's characterized is, I don't know if any other English majors remember Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier, but like this, she's like Florence, like she's on the verge of having a like old school apoplectic nitro requiring swoon fit of some sort at all times. And yet she's managing to be a borderline personality who's cheating on the narrator. Like, I may be misremembering that, but not really. Like, this conception is so Edwardian.
Yeah.
And how he has to take care of her is just bizarre. That's A. B, nobody talks like this. I know it's a soap. Mm-hmm. Nobody talks like this, but especially Jess would not talk like this about anything. So I just wanted to say that Dan Cortez has some occasionally intriguing line readings that aren't what you expect, but he does a pretty good job with this. And as portraying Jess as what he is, which is a guy who manages to manipulate situations by being defensive and self-pitying.
Yeah.
I gave this so much more thought than anyone else who was there shooting the scene. Welcome to our podcast. Hello.
Yeah, I don't think he's bad. Like his role in the show is to be like a semi-con artist, but like very small time. And like you said, his angle is, I'm a sad sack, like feel bad for me and look the other way when I'm obviously like picking your pockets, basically.
Right. Because I'll find a way to blame that on you and feel sorry for myself. And sometimes it's just easier to be like, fine, whatever you say.
Yes. But the most funny part is at the end of this, he's like, my mistake. And then he just stands up and doesn't move. Like he just waits for Jake to be like, no, don't go, even though he's not going anywhere. He's just like standing there.
Oh my God. Waiting
for Jake to feel guilty, which like Jake immediately does, telling him to stay and offering him a job at Shooters. And Jess goes, all right, little brother, put me on the payroll. And Jake makes this face like, oh, I wasn't going to make it official. And I didn't think you were going to stay long enough to get taxes withheld. But okay, I guess. Also funny.
Yeah. Also, if you're looking for drinking games during the Jess arc, baby brother, little brother, big brother, like I swear to God, like siblings absolutely do not ever address each other in this way, except on television.
Never. No. Mm-mm. No. Zero times have I called my sister sis or she me.
Yeah. I mean, I've called my parents bro more often than I've called my brother bro. Like, he has a name. It's Dave. Why don't we catch new viewers up that way?
Right. Ugh. Yeah, that's true. I may have called her bro more than sis because I've called her sis zero times. Anyway.
Yeah.
So then it's time for Jess's first shift. It falls to Sydney to train him on how to bus tables. And I'll just note the guy employees apparently get Shooter's logo t-shirts, whereas the ladies are in black, just low cut tops. And I guess I get it if you work for tips, but, you know, that said, I immediately went looking for a website selling a version of the Shooter's t-shirt and found one. And there's a link in the show notes. So if you want to get one, you can.
Nice.
When Jake is gone, Sydney advises Jess to say he wants to work cocktail hours because there's mostly drinks and fewer plates. But Jess haughtily says he will work when Jake tells him to work. And Sydney's like, all right.
All right, gallant.
Seriously. So Sydney wants to know what Jake was like as a kid. Like, were there any girls who were special? And Jess pointedly says that unlike Jess himself, Jake never let anyone get too close, conveniently leaving out the part where, like, Jess himself is divorced. But amid and around further bar chat as Sydney is trying to, like, show him the ropes, Jess gets the actually true, although abbreviated, story of Jake and Sydney's breakup. And he says this, clip three.
A word to the wise, Sid. The handsome boys are known for carrying a grudge. You see, forgive and forget's not in our vocabulary.
You bust the dishes, wipe off the tables, and if the condiments are running low, tell the waitress. And for your information, Jake and I belong together. He's just taking longer to realize it.
I mean, just when you think she's really like, okay, I'm going to blossom into like a true schemer and stop being self-destructive in this particular way, then she says something like this. Sigh.
Yeah. I'm also going to add the Hansen boys or the Hansen brothers to your drinking game. That's another one that comes up a lot.
And it did sound like he said the handsome boys. And I was like, well, even Ted Williams only batted 406. Just kidding. They're both cute.
That night, Joe is drinking and shit-talking Allison. We'll get to it. When Jess rolls up, greeting Joe with a, hey, beautiful, that takes her aback because she had not heard he was working there. But that's not all. Jake is letting him sleep on the cot in the back office. And Joe is appalled to hear that. But Jake says Jess wanted it that way, and Jess backs him up. Joe offers to take Jake out for dinner. Jake says he can't leave so early, but Jess says he and Sydney can close. And when Jake hesitates, Jess jokes with an edge that Jake doesn't trust them. And Jake denies it. Joe basically orders Jake to say yes, so Jake reluctantly hands over the keys rather than tell Jess about Sydney's cult friend who stole them from Sydney and trashed the place the last time she had the keys. But also, if Jess is sleeping there, like, what's the difference? He's already going to be there at close. Like, he would also have keys unless Jake was planning to lock him in overnight from the outside, which, like, what?
Yeah. Anyway. Jesus.
Contrivance. So, after close, Jess waits for Sydney to leave and then starts going through Jake's papers in his office. But Sydney only pretended to leave, sneaks back to catch Jess in the act and confront him. And he says it's none of her business, but when pushed, says he was making sure Jake isn't letting anyone take advantage of him. And Sydney says this, clip four.
You may have Jake snowed, but I've known guys like you. You're not here to change your life. You're up to something.
You know something, Sid? There's one sure way to lose a boyfriend. Stick your nose in his family business.
I'm gonna tell Jake.
That would be a big mistake. If you want to stay out of harm's way.
There it is.
This is such an interesting, I mean, aside from the, like, sad piano followed by sex guitar, it's like, well, you know, we paid for it, so we're using it. He's threatening her, and she looks like she's sort of taken the information on board and decided to think he's full of shit. And then cut to him being like, oops. Like, he sort of is, I don't know if that was Cortez's intention, but he's sort of playing it like, oh, like maybe she's as devious as I am. But it's like, look, she was married to Michael Mancini.
Right.
Brohim. No.
Yeah. There's also something about the staging, though, that I don't love, since we all, like, this season, Sydney was sexually assaulted in this place.
And in that room.
Right. Was it? Yes, you're right. And she was
by a man who is still at large. Thank you for the assist.
Did not mean to. That wasn't why I brought it up, but you're right.
Didn't need your help, but I'll take the on-ramp. Thank you.
But we keep saying she's teeny tiny, and Dan Cortez, like, he's looks like a door. Like, he's giant compared to her.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, is twice her size. So it's like, I mean, I'm glad the scene just ends where it does, but I don't like it.
Well, yeah. And it is definitely, like, it can be hard. Well, it isn't that hard to tell. Like, the show almost never sides with Sydney, and, like, I guess we're not supposed to, even though you and I always do. So when they shoot sort of, like, down on her from, like, over his shoulder, it's like, she's little. You can't. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, you're right about that.
Well, I don't think they actually do frame it that way. I mean, the size difference is only because we know it. Like, I think they do shoot her head on for that reason, like, to make her look stronger, because otherwise it would be like, oh my God, someone protect this tiny woman.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, the next day, the Hanson brothers drink, go surfing. A thing we learned on 90210 that Jake does, but have literally never seen him do on that show or this one until right now. And we still haven't, because they're just like walking out of the ocean.
Yeah. Hmm.
But Jess says he had always planned to move to L.A. after high school, but then that night happened. So Jake kind of has to talk about it. Clip 5.
You know, I think about that night a lot. You getting busted.
Wasn't the Hanson brothers' finest hour.
Well, I can't help but feel guilty. I can't help but think that, you know, if I come forward, things would be different.
Look, I'm not here to dredge up the past. The hell with it, okay?
Cool.
Okay. So tell me something, little brother.
Drake,
what's the deal with you and Sydney?
Friends.
Friends?
Yeah.
Look, it's none of my business, but your friend, Sydney, is carrying a big grudge and it's aimed right at you.
Yeah, well, deal with Sydney is long and complicated. I don't want to get to it right now.
Like I said, none of my business. But she is your employee. I hate to see her take advantage of your big heart.
Nah, Sydney means well.
Just the same. I'll keep an eye on her. Somebody's got to watch out for my baby brother.
So you mean you can stick around for a while?
That had crossed my mind.
Good. That's good. So why don't you ditch that cot and move into my place with me? At least till you get your own place.
Okay, I'll do it.
Cool.
I'll move in.
Weirdly directed, but I guess a second take on the beach was not in the schedule. So there we are.
Yeah, and that's it for this plot line. So I guess we'll see in the next episode if Sydney actually does follow through on her threat to dime Jess out to Jake. Spoiler, she doesn't.
Well, she's a little busy, but we'll get to it.
Well, that's true. So we have so much more show to get to. But first, we have a birthday message for Austin.
Austin is about to celebrate her second pandemic birthday. Been there. Sorry, buddy. And wanted to treat herself. She spent quarantine with her husband, Kevin, and I'm quoting now, two mostly wonderful children, Finn and Rowan. She sent us a picture and they really do look adorable. So this was probably mostly fun.
Since Austin's been spending this intense time with her family and listening to our podcast, she wanted to know, which of the Bev Niners would we each most and least want to have been quarantined with for the past 14 months? And let's say any of the opening credits kid characters from all 10 seasons are up for grabs, because obviously Nat, because he'd just give us free food, is too easy.
True. I was tempted to say Matt because you wouldn't even know he's there because he's so boring, but I'm actually going to say Claire Arnold. I think we are probably the most compatible in terms of personality for long-term living, and she doesn't seem like a shitwit when it comes to domestic and roommate stuff. She's not an idiot, despite having been attracted to Brandon. And her dad, the chancellor, can probably get us access to CU facilities at off hours so we can go, like, be in the pool and just get out of the beach apartment and not be confined to the balcony of contemplation.
Nice. I think I would most like to be quarantined with Dylan for, I'll just say it, horny reasons. The 15-year-old who first met him and thought he was the dreamiest thing she had literally ever seen is still in me. I honor her, and I'm going to give her this. He has a cute little house. He has a TV. I could probably talk him into upgrading the shitty futon to a decent couch after about the fourth month of sitting on it all the time.
Yeah.
He would probably go out surfing on a fairly regular basis to give us a break from too much closeness. And if he got into his Kerouac bullshit, I could just pretend to be asleep.
Fair enough. All right, moving on to our least desirable quarantine mates. I thought this would be tougher than it was because there are some Hall of Fame buttholes to choose from in the credits cast, but the most unbearable from a living together standpoint, as well as, you know, all the others, has got to be that bitch, David. He's up all night with the meth. He's drinking all the orange juice with the meth. He's clogging the toilet with the meth.
Yep.
He's stealing and bouncing rent checks because of the meth. He might set shit on fire because he doesn't tidy up and pay attention to where the space heaters are plugged in.
Yep.
God forbid he decide to work on his music at any time. And he's Lord Pissface. Not about it. Don't even want to be in the same building. David, thumbs down.
Yeah. I mean, you left one out, which is, we know canonically from the show, anytime he experiences the least amount of stress, he takes it out on whoever is nearest to him, normally Donna. And in this case, it would be you. Like, no. I mean, it wouldn't be that bad because he would end up dead. But
well, I was going to say, I think that's only going to be attempted once. And then you and I, a pair of shovels and the beach under a full moon.
True. So who I would least like to be quarantined with, and this might seem like a wild choice, but hear me out. Brenda. I love her rage, her indignation, her ability to throw a full bitch fit on the flimsiest pretext. That's the same thing phrased three different ways. The point is, while I enjoy watching that energy from a safe distance, I think being shut up with it, even in a very large home like the Walsh House, would not be fun. And that as the months rolled on, her mood would almost certainly not improve. Basically, I don't think pandemic conditions would bring out Brenda's best self.
I agree with you. Like, she thrives on drama and with no one there to provide it except people with whom she's quarantining. Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah, no.
Yeah.
Good choice. Austin, we hope you and your husband are on the road to full vaccination, if not already arrived at immunity. Finn and Rowan, just hang out. You don't look 16. While some of us were unlucky enough to have had two pandemic birthdays, at least this is probably also the last pandemic birthday for most of us in this country. We hope both your pandemic birthdays were as joyful as could be, and we're so happy to have been a little part of this one.
From all of us here, happy birthday,
Austin! Happy birthday, Austin!
On to our A-plot. The Mancinis and the D&Ders all form a Rat King, basically.
This made me laugh so hard.
Should we explain what a Rat King is for people who don't know?
Please do.
Okay. A Rat King is when you get a whole bunch of rats acting all crazy and their tails all get tangled up. So they're basically uncontrollable. That's a Rat King.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the idea is that they're become one unit. That's the scary part. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's why it's very apropos as a metaphor for this plotline. So.
Yeah.
Michael is watching over an unconscious Amanda in her ICU bed when Matt rolls by for his one and a half scene to spy on them through the glass door. And when Michael sees Matt, he comes out to report that Amanda's not doing great, but asks him not to spread it around the complex. He actually looks drawn, as you can see in the visual aids. They, like, did something to his cheekbones where, like, he looks rough.
Mm.
More so than they've done to Amanda, by the way, while she's been, you know, having cancer treatment.
Mm.
Michael says he actually regrets recommending the radical treatment that Amanda's been on. And Matt tells him to go home and rest. And Michael resists at first, but then notes that with Kimberly in Minnesota, he has the house to himself. LOL, you thought. Mm-hmm. Michael realizes how wrong he is as soon as he steps inside. And Kimberly, lying in wait on the couch, snaps on a lamp to ambush him with Amanda's lingerie. Michael goes into counterattack mode, saying Amanda's clinging to life and so on. And Kimberly is like, so she willed you her wonder bras, which is pretty good line. Michael spins the story of why he moved Amanda in and who slept where, and he just wanted to give her a reason to live and blah, blah, blah. And Kimberly says it's so like him to put everyone else first, and she hopes Amanda appreciates her caring and conscientious physician. She knows how lucky she is to have such an honest and loving husband, which somehow Michael does not read all of this as pure sarcasm. And so she calls him onto the couch to kiss her, and as soon as his tongue is in her mouth, she bites down hard enough to draw blood and tells him love hurts. And, like, I wouldn't do this because I would assume Michael is not conscientious about condom use, but he does deserve this and worse. Over to D&D, where Joe is complaining to Billy about Allison having no time to explain the new Glorious Gowns campaign concept to her. Please go to the visual aids to see Joe's insane layer situation in this moment, because it's like long sweater, long something kind of silky slip or tunic or something, and then another long layer of under that with lace, and then leggings or tights. It's very 95.
I feel like that was in the mid to late 90s, something that we saw a lot with skirts, that there was like the top layer and then the bottom slip layer that was intentionally showing. So I think that's what was going on. But she also has this, like, later in the episode, this like convertible top where it's huge bell sleeves that are, designed to catch on fire at a restaurant. But then I think they zip off like mid upper arm. It's extremely 90s. And her hair, I mean, it looks good, but it's huge. It's very tall.
Yeah. It's like B-52's hair almost. Mm-hmm.
It's a big one.
We also see later in the scene that her top is a turtleneck and she's got a chain over it, which, like, no.
Hey, if it's good enough for Judith Light.
Okay, fair. So Allison enters just then. Her skirt is noticeably shorter than we've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Like, they're Amanda-fying her by like a half an inch every episode. Mm-hmm. Very funny. And her patience is shorter too. Clip six.
Get Betsy and whoever on the phone with me. Now, on second thought, I need to talk to the printer first. So, Joe, Billy tells me there's a problem with the location.
No, I told you.
The location fell through. What?
We'll find another house. We'll find another house.
In less than 48 hours? I doubt it. You did this on purpose, didn't you? You didn't like the house, the garden, the lights.
Allison, I wouldn't deliberately sabotage a campaign.
Allison, you've got auditions in the conference room. You're already 10 minutes late.
Well, I guess we should cancel them. I mean, we don't have anywhere to shoot the models once we book them.
Look, I can see you're swamped. Why don't I book the models, and then you can put your heads together and come up with a new location. Fine.
And Joe, your butt's on the line here. I just want you to know that.
I think we need to talk about your people management skills.
I don't need your advice, Billy. What I need is a location for the shoot. Find one.
I mean, I'm sorry, but like, of all the non-issues in Los Angeles, like, wherever will we find a set?
Yeah.
Seriously? Anyway.
Yeah, this is another, I feel like, business thing with them, where it's like they this is one piece of conflict they can think of because they've used it before.
Yeah,
like a
sure.
location fell through, which is why there were so many shoots on the boat when there was a boat.
That's right.
Anyway. Brooke volunteers her father's house in Pasadena as a replacement location, and I don't know why Allison immediately waves this off. Like, if Brooke can get by on a three-day-a-week intern job in her mid-20s, she obviously comes from money, so Brooke basically has to out herself as a rich. And then Allison tells Billy to check it out and get back to her. So then he's driving his dumb car through the automatic gates and up the very long drive to Brooke's dad's gigantic, super tacky estate. Clip seven.
I hope you don't have anything against rich women, Campbell.
I'm not sure. How rich are you?
Filthy.
I kind of love her.
I kind of love her. And he is being given these, like, he's being given this, like, desk set, Tracy Hepburn sort of lines that he's actually doing really well with in this episode. It's a little disconcerting and it doesn't totally play, but he apparently just is like, fuck it. And his line readings are funny to me. Like, he's just sort of disgusted as Billy, but then also as Andrew Shue, he doesn't really know what he's doing. Yeah. So he can't tighten up and do it wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know. It works for me for some reason. I like them together.
I like her so much that I wish she was with someone stronger. Like her plus Michael's, like, that's something I would like to see. And I,
yeah, that's almost too much.
Maybe.
She's the accent color, I feel. And then you need some nice industrial grayish like Billy.
Fair enough. So as they walk around the grounds, Billy says it'll be great for the shoot. And then she leads him to a corner with a swing bench and clip 8.
What do you think?
Well, it's a great backdrop, you know. I think Allison's going to flip.
Oh, I don't think I want you to shoot here.
Why not?
Well, this is a very special place. This is where I lost my virginity.
Well, shouldn't there be a plaque somewhere?
I remember sneaking up here with my boyfriend. The two of us undressing each other and running our hands all over each other. And all the while, my father was standing in the window of the library, smoking his pipe. No clue what was going on.
Pretty sure that's not true. Also, you're creepy.
Yeah. Yuck.
My father, VC Andrews. All right, Audrino.
Before Billy has a chance to react to this, or Brooke's nose millimeters away from his, friggin' Patrick Fabian comes over a little bridge toward her, and she runs over to kiss him while Billy stands by looking dumb. And Brooke introduces Patrick as Lowell Burrows, her fiancé. And Billy squints suspiciously and notes that she never told him she was engaged. Over to the hospital. Kimberly's at reception, testily looking for Michael, when Scott from the insurance company shows up looking for him also. Kimberly's like, I'm Mrs. Mancini. And Scott, who I guess has a pretty serious case of face blindness, says he didn't recognize her and cheerfully says it's good to see her out of bed. She has no idea what he's talking about, so he reminds her that they met at the beach house and he has the $100,000 check for their settlement, which is when Kimberly decides to start yes-anding him and is like, oh, yes, of course, the check. I can take it. Thank you. Bye. So... Meanwhile, Kimberly's loving husband is holding hands with Amanda as she wakes up in the ICU. And he's like, while you were unconscious, I realized I really love you and want to be with you, as though he has not been saying that in every one of their interactions for several episodes now. This is, again, for the new viewers.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, I need to rest. And as he leaves, the camera stays on her, and I expected her to do an oh, fuck face, but she does just go to sleep. And when he steps out into the hall, clip 9.
Bite me again, I drive a stake through your heart.
An agent from the city's insurance company stopped by with this check.
Well, then hand it over, Kimberly.
I know what you're up to, Michael. You're trying to steal my money. Well, you know what? It is your lucky day. I am feeling very generous. It's all yours. All you have to do is kiss your terminally ill girlfriend goodbye.
Oh, man, it's not my girlfriend. She's my patient.
What's it gonna be, Michael? Cold, hard cash or the bleached blonde with dark roots? All it takes is one word. Goodbye, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, adieu.
Auf Wiedersehen is two words.
If you want $100,000, I get lost.
Well, you know, this really has nothing to do with Amanda. But you and I have been through a hell of a lot to be together. I mean, you know, I want our marriage to work. I'm willing to give it a try if you are.
I knew you'd come to your senses.
So, how about that check?
I thought I'd put it in our joint account as a sign of our commitment to one another.
Sure. Whatever you say, sweetheart.
I mean, this is being dragged out unnecessarily as they wait for the finale. Mm-hmm. But they are both making the most of it. And I love it. Like that it's, I mean, it's so dark how this is being played for laughs. Like Alf Peterson is actually two words. Like, who wrote this?
Yeah.
But I love it. I love it.
And the scene ends with them kissing on it, and the camera stays on him because this is the act out, and he's just like rolling his eyes.
Like mugging unbelievably while it's kissing her. Amazing.
Gorgeous. You can see it in the visual aids. Of course, I gift it, mm-hmm. obviously. So the next day, there's a hilarious shot of three black extras at D&D, which I'm pretty sure is three times as many black people as we've seen in any single frame of this show since Rhonda was a series regular. Mm. And I'm not kidding. Mm. Like,
no.
Truly.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Before the camera quickly moves off them and onto Brooke in a hideous nutcrackery red and black jacket you can see in the visual aids. Rolling up to Billy with some instructions, quickly chased by flirty banter, he deflects. She wants to take him to lunch, but he turns that down too. And when she presses, he's like, "You are engaged." Whereupon she switches off the purr in her voice and is like, "Guess you can't be friends with someone you're so obviously attracted to. Okay, cuckoo." And Allison comes in just then, all smiles for Brooke, one of the last people in the joint she could still be nice to, apparently. And then tells Billy that Michael reports Amanda's well enough to have visitors. What happened to no one at the complex finding out she was hospitalized? I mean, what? And then Allison adds that Amanda's probably going to have a line of visitors at the door. Like, is she? No one likes her.
Yeah. Didn't we just do this? Didn't we just do this Dickens thing where nobody's at a funeral? Like, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Didn't she just raise everyone's rent? Like, they're probably all hoping
she
dies.
That's right. Nice.
Anyway. Allison quickly changes the subject to the other night when they fucked on her desk, and Billy reminds her that when he brought that up, she didn't want to talk about it, but she was just overwhelmed by work. He claims he also has a full plate of bullshit, but he's not confused about his feelings. And she counterclaims she's not either. He's the only thing keeping her going, which grim if true.
Girl, Jesus.
Yeah. So that night, Matt leads a group of visitors to Amanda's hospital room. Jane with elegant orchid, Billy with some kind of grandmotherly pink plant, Allison, single rose she bought off some dude wherever she was eating dinner, I assume, mm-hmm. and Brooke met Amanda one time while Amanda was learning in the tackiest possible way she had lost her job. Like, why are you there? Yeah. So when Jane goes in, Allison realizes she's the last person Amanda wants to see. Like, A, duh, and B, you're figuring this out now and not on the drive over or at any point earlier today or since you let her go. Billy claims Amanda would come and see Allison if the situation were reversed, which is true, but that would be to lord it over Allison, who would probably not want to see Amanda. So if Allison's not there to gloat, she should leave. And she does, to her credit, giving her dumb rose to Brooke to pass on with Allison's best wishes. And at Shooters, Allison's supposed best friend, Joe, is talking a bunch of shit about her to Jake. Clip 10.
I swear I'm not exaggerating, Jake. Allison's become impossible to deal with. I have a photo shoot the day after tomorrow. She can't even find the time to discuss a concept with me.
She's got some pretty big shoes to fill.
And what? She's eventually gonna get the hang of it? I don't think so. I mean, some jobs are just too big for some people. You know, for all her faults, Amanda really had her act together.
I mean, yes? Yeah.
Like, you hated her also. She was also a bitch to you, but I guess she was better in retrospect. Who knows?
Mm.
Jake mentions that Amanda's receiving visitors, which, again, we never saw anyone find out she was even hospitalized. And Joe says she knows, but does not seem in a hurry to go pay her respects. And
fair.
Back at the hospital, Amanda's apparently making a list of who loves her enough to show up and checking it twice. Clip 11.
So who else came to visit me and what did they bring?
Jake was here twice, only you were out of it.
Yeah, he brought you a dozen roses. Actually, more than a dozen.
Oh, how sweet. What about Joe?
We got you this orchid.
Oh, you both went in on it together?
It was very expensive.
Oh, well, you shouldn't have.
Oh, look, I'm sorry. I'll be back, okay? We were all very worried about you.
Thanks for the flowers. Excuse me. Do I know you?
Yes. We met at the Century Awards, Brooke Armstrong.
She's interning at D&D.
Really?
Yes, I'm Allison's new assistant, but it's not a permanent position. Oh, this is for you. It's from Allison. She wishes you a speedy recovery.
I bet she does. Brooke, would you be so kind as to deliver Allison a message? Tell her I've got some bad news. She's going to have to put away her dancing shoes, because I'm not dead yet.
Ooh. She also threw the rose on the floor, by the way.
Gorgeous.
Like, just let it fall off the bed to the side. Perfect.
I mean, am I wrong? This is totally like a restaurant job. It has like the plastic cone around it, you know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's someone selling it at the intersection as yes. You get off the freeway.
Yes. When you don't care enough to send the very least this rose. Sometime later, Kimberly takes her turn checking in with Amanda to announce that she and Michael are back together. Amanda doesn't know two people who deserve each other more. I feel like Heather Locklear is playing this like, I'm just going to say whatever will end this interaction because Kimberly is batshit. She already threatened to murder me once. Furthermore, I don't really care about Michael either way.
Yeah, that was the predominating, like my notes are like, oh, Kimberly. Like Kimberly is so smug about winning something that Amanda's like, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Like, I let you have this one.
Right.
Who cares? Yeah.
However, Kimberly goes on preening clip 12.
We had a long talk and came to a mutual understanding. Now he's mine, bought and paid for.
Honestly, Kimberly, spare me the details. Michael is my doctor, nothing more.
That's right. Your relationship is now strictly professional.
What are you doing here?
Oh, I was just sharing our good news. Get well soon. I'll see you at home.
Amanda, I can explain this.
Don't bother. I won't be put in the middle of your matrimonial machinations.
You're not in the middle. My relationship with Kimberly is over.
Oh.
Well, it will be soon.
Whatever you say. And I want to be left alone.
Sure.
So this time we get her reaction as he leaves, which seems to be faint dismay, but like the faintest. She does not care.
Yeah.
Over to the photo shoot. J.D. Roth is back, although he's gotten a demotion from Jack in Otherwise Engaged to just Joe's assistant here. Sad. Mm-hmm. Allison shows up already raging. Elsewhere, Brooke introduces Billy to her Silver Fox dad, Perry King from Riptide. Here, his name is Haley, H-A-Y-L-E-Y. That was a name given to boys in the 1940s when this guy was born? Okay. Seems weird to me.
I mean, so were Leslie and Dana and Courtney.
I guess.
Who knows?
Brooke does not seem to mind that Haley gives away how she's been talking up Billy. Clip 13.
She also told me that you're the vice president of D&D advertising?
I'm one of the VPs. I oversee accounts.
I'm impressed. To be given that kind of responsibility at your age, you must be either very talented or very lucky.
A little of both.
It doesn't hurt that he was engaged to his boss. Allison Parker, president of D&D.
And my daughter's boss as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Daddy, I'm not really an employee. I'm just an intern.
Sweetie, you've been putting in such long hours. I was sure you had a permanent position at the agency.
Well, Mr. Armstrong, she does now.
Allison, I don't know what to say.
Just keep up the good work, right?
Right.
There's a great moment during this where Billy, like, figures out how Brooke arranged all of this, and you can see that in the visual aids. He's like...
Yeah. Mm. Also, everything about this is such a bad look on Allison.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, good job, Brooke.
Yeah.
She gets results.
She does. Allison then goes stalking off to look at Joe's Polaroids and immediately launch into a bitch fit, clip 14.
God, this is perfect. It's going to be great. What do you think, Allison?
Right.
I think it's wrong. It's all wrong. Why are you shooting up against this wall?
This is what I see for the shot. The romance of first love, a traditional wedding.
No, no, Joe. This is supposed to be contemporary, happening. Our bride is a 90s Cinderella. She doesn't just dance with her Prince Charming. She talks deals on her cellular phone. She throws the wicked stepsisters into the pool. Allison, you can't just throw this at me now. Not the day of the shoot. You should have told me this 2 weeks ago. You're the photographer, Joe. Make the adjustment. Make it work.
It's not that simple, Allison.
Well, then let me simplify it for you. I want my vision incorporated into your photographs. I want you to move your equipment over to the pool. If you're up for it, fine. If you're not, I'll find someone more professional who is.
Oh, yeah, give me a break. I'm the only professional here. You're way over your head trying to fill Amanda's shoes.
Just do it, Joe. My way.
There it is.
I mean, but she's not even, like, I, you know, understand Joe's legitimate frustration, but it's like there's something so pathetic about how she's like spinning out because she doesn't know what she's doing. That's like, I don't know if this rises to the level of bitch. I think she's just Peter principled. Thanks to the business of the writers. But yeah. Also, the suit she's wearing in this entire sequence of scenes is horrible.
Yeah.
The writers clearly hate her. It's lime green. No, it's in the visual aids.
Well, I don't think I don't think the writers hate Courtney Thorne Smith. I do think they are not fond of Allison.
Yeah.
This is like just another way they're underscoring, like, she is not in her correct element because it's not her shade.
No.
So at home that night by the mailboxes, Allison comments that there should be a law against junk mail. And Joe's like, bye. Allison is like, clip 15.
Joe? What? Sensing some hostility here. We should talk.
Oh, was there something you forgot to say to me earlier?
Look, Joe, I'm sorry if I wounded your ego. But as president of D&D, if you mess up, it becomes my mess. I'm under a lot of pressure to make this new Glorious Gowns campaign a success.
I know. Your butt's on the line. But you know what? You're dealing with it by becoming a totally self-centered ass.
I'll just chalk that one up to a long day.
Don't. You were completely rude and ungrateful. I didn't hear a please or a thank you come out of your mouth all day.
I don't believe this. We wouldn't even be having this conversation if I was a man.
Wrong. Allison, you're kidding yourself if you think attitude's going to get you to the top.
Nice guys finish last. Or hadn't you heard?
Fine. Stop being a human being. I really don't give a damn.
What's annoying about this is that they earlier in the episode seeded what Joe's problem was, which is I've been trying to get time with Allison to talk about what her concept is for this campaign, and she's been blowing me off. So Allison being like, here's the XYZ of what I want. And Joe wasn't like, I mean, she said in the moment, you never told me any of this, so I'm not prepared to do any of that because you never told me. This is what she should have said now. The issue isn't that you're being a bitch. The issue is that you're not prepared. Like, you're not doing everything in the correct order. You're not giving me the tools that I need as a contractor to deliver your vision. Like, that's the problem.
Right. I mean, this is sort of what I was saying before. Like, it's not that she's it's not that she's a bitch. It's that she's not competent and not organized. So,
yes. But that's what's annoying about this exchange, where it's like part of it is that her interpersonal skills are terrible. Yeah. Part of it is like, she's just not handling herself. Like, hire more help.
Well, and I also don't like as incompetent as Allison can also be, like, interpersonally, I feel like this is beyond as far as like her thinking that everything would be. Like, let's make a, you know, what's the deal with airline peanuts joke at the mailbox and everything will be cool. Like, I don't think even Allison is that estranged from consequences of yelling at people. I don't know. It's weird. I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to other machinations bringing it into this period of all of our lives.
Yeah.
Step on it, Brooke.
What Allison is not getting is that if you're going to be raging around the office like Amanda, first of all, you have to have the goods to back it up. And second, you just have to be like that all the time because she is.
it's true.
So then at the hospital. Kimberly's with a bunch of her colleagues when she gets served with, as we learn, when she chases Michael down to yell at him about it, divorce papers. Clip 16.
You misrepresented yourself, Kimberly. You knew how important having a family was to me. You promised to give me one, and now you're barren. You can't deliver the goods.
No one could be this cruel.
It's valid grounds for ending the marriage. Just ask your lawyer.
Michael, please.
I want out, Kimberly. I'm in love with someone else. Someone who's wonderful and normal.
Amanda, she's as good as dead.
No. Actually, her prognosis is good. And thanks to your insurance money, we can live happily ever after.
How long have you been planning this?
Ever since you walked back in my life like a refugee from the night of the living dead.
I understand your feelings for me were just an act.
You bet. And I deserve an Academy Award for my performance. Best actor in a bedroom farce. You know, every time I kissed you, all I thought about was that insurance loot coming my way. It was the only thing that kept me from gagging. Oh, I need to get my clothes. You know what? I'll stop by the house tomorrow night at 8. Do us both a favor. Don't be there. And, honey, this is a hospital. Get a grip. That patient's depending on you.
I know he's just saying this to end the conversation or, like, try to extricate himself as easily as possible. But I feel like we agree. He really did love or was, like, strangely fascinated by Kimberly at one point.
Yeah. Like, since she's returned, I mean, I assume he's just trying to be so cruel that it will, like, wound her sufficiently that she'll stay away from him.
Yeah.
I think this is a misapprehension of her particular brand of relationship with emotional reality, but okay. Mm-hmm. But it's, like, so over the top, like, for him to claim to her that he wanted a family and she couldn't give it to him is like,
oh yeah, that's the worst part.
Snort.
Of course.
Like we all saw those episodes, including Kimberly. Come on.
Yeah. Yes. That's the norm of the satire, as it were. But like, yeah, the idea that he was like barfing when he was having sex with her, like, buddy, no, we all know.
No.
Crazy in the head, crazy in the bed.
That's which offensive. Would explain why people keep falling for your bullshit, apparently.
Moving on. At D&D the next day, Brooke gets a huge bouquet and opens a note that she puts away too quickly for us to read initially, other than the signature, which is Amanda's. But when Allison and Billy roll in asking whom they're from, she lies that they're from Lowell, her fiancé. And Allison, of course, has not heard of him either, but she wants to meet him. The four of them should have dinner later, which is like making a very couple-y assumption, and we'll get back to that. Really does not say,
yeah.
No, I don't want to go out for dinner with you as though we were a couple. Just whatever, we'll get to it. So when they've left, Brooke pulls the card out again so we can read it. It's Amanda congratulating Brooke on her new job and asking her to come and see Amanda in the hospital. Speaking of whom, Michael tells Amanda he's looked at her blood work. She's doing super great. He then asks if she's got a kiss for her doctor, and she's in the middle of nicely putting him off when Brooke shows up, and Amanda is able then to kick him out, and then announces she's going home soon and going back to work at D&D, but she needs a favor. Clip 17.
Sure. I mean, I don't know you all that well, but
let me tell you a few things about myself. I built D&D from the ground up. It was mine. Then I got sick and Allison moved in. But when I'm at full strength, I am a tough, vindictive boys' club member. I don't give up, and I don't give in. And now that I'm feeling better, I intend to get my job back from Allison. And when I do, I'm going to turn that agency upside down. The only thing left standing will be the file cabinets. But I need an advance team. I want you to be my eyes and ears at D&D.
Do you mean like your spy?
Exactly. Or consider yourself fired.
Well, I don't mean to be rude, but from what Allison says, you're never coming back.
Well, you can listen to Allison, or you can listen to me. But I think we both know a sure thing when we see it.
And at this, Brooke kind of does shifty eyes like, you're in the hospital being treated for cancer, though? Just like, fair.
Yeah, at times the show seems to assume that Brooke is a viewer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like, oh, well, of course I would, you know, of course I would throw in with Amanda. Like,
mm-hmm.
Amanda was like steps from death's door a couple days ago, but all yeah. right. Like, you know, I guess she's supposed to know what we know, which she, I mean, she might. Like, I don't remember exactly when Brooke's scheming to get into the D&D door started. So it's possible that she has done her research and this was the lane she meant to end up in all along, but I don't remember. I'll find out.
Yeah. Just content warning about this scene. It's about a suicide attempt. So we join Kimberly in the beach house that night, writing Michael what sounds a lot like a suicide note. She says he's been an addiction she hasn't been strong enough to free herself from, and so on. She takes a swig of liquor from the bottle and then takes some pills out of the kitchen cupboard, wanders out to the deck with her note and bottle, and pours a huge handful of pills into her hand, chokes them down with a huge belt of liquor. Over weirdly pale lobster, or is it? Did that lobster look weird to you? It looked too pink to me.
I didn't even notice the lobster. Oh, all right. I was focused on the fact that she was apparently trying to wash down the pills with like vermouth. It was just a weird choice.
Oh, lobster's in the next scene. Sorry. That's a dinner. There's no lobster with Kimberly. Lobster is at dinner with Allison and Billy and Brooke and Lowell.
Oh, okay.
But obviously, if you didn't notice it, it's probably normal lobster, I guess, or a prop from the 70s. Regardless, at the dinner table, Allison toasts Brooke and Lowell's happiness. There's no wedding date yet because of Lowell's busy schedule as an investment banker. What?
Finance.
Yeah.
Whatever.
That's as weird excuses for putting off a wedding goes, that's one of the weirder ones.
Yeah. And if he's that busy, he can pay a wedding planner, but all right.
Mm-hmm. So she lets Lowell kiss her on her left temple. Her right hand is under the table, fondling Billy's leg until he excuses himself to go to the can, where Brooke follows him and kisses him. And he says he usually makes it a policy not to kiss women whose fiancés are having dinner with him, but she growls that Lowell is just a business deal and she doesn't love him. Her dad picked him to run the family business when he retires, but... Clip 18.
But I have plans of my own. I'm going to run Daddy's companies, and I'm going to choose the father of my children. And from the first moment we met, I knew it wasn't going to be Lowell.
Okay. From the moment we met, as in... she and Billy, or she and Lowell? Like, has she been on the prowl for a better addiction since she met Lowell, or she only decided that when she met Billy, it matters?
Yeah. And like, if it's both, just rewrite the line.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah, it's very weird.
So Billy's trying to get her off, and when some other dude walks in and then like theatrically checks that he's in the right bathroom when he sees her, but... Brooke just crazy eyes, smiles, and leaves, telling Billy to zip his fly. And then Michael's getting home, seeing Kimberly's legs on a chaise on the deck. Again, this is content warning. This is the end of that previous scene. He yells that he told her not to be there. When she doesn't respond, he goes out to yell right in her face, but changes mood, sort of, when he can't wake her up and sees the empty pill bottle, stalking back inside to call 911. Before looking down at her face and deciding to hang up instead. I mean, you'll see his face in still and GIF form in the visual aids, but oh boy.
I mean, he has this moment, and while they're fading to black, where he like sticks his tongue out and sort of exults.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I mean, it's so dark that he was sort of hot to me. Like, this is usually Tara's cup of meat.
It's true.
It's not for me, but I was like, oh, don't wiggle your way into my pants. Mm-hmm. In this way at this moment.
Yeah. Ugh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have to give Calabro credit.
He's got a gift.
He does.
And that's it.
Yeah,
for the episode. Let us close it up by naming our episode MVP. I mean, you said it early, Sarah. Brooke gets shit done, and
she does.
Got herself into a job very quickly. She's only been at D&D for like an episode and a half before getting a full-time job. So, you know, not bad.
Yeah. I would give an honorable mention to Bathroom Extra, who, in addition to looking like Cletus from The Simpsons, like live action, is definitely maximizing his double take moment here.
Yeah, he's also been Gift. He's in the visual aids, of course.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's no Brooke, but he's up there.
Least valuable player. Allison, bitchy and incompetent.
Scott, the insurance guy. Is it your first day on Earth? I'm sincerely asking.
Yeah, that's fair.
Next time on Again With This, Jess plays Joe and Jake off each other. Amanda and Brooke play Allison like a fiddle. And when it comes to Mancini thermonuclear war, the only winning move is not to play. Our visual aids will play war games with your eyeballs. You'll find those at our website, No Hacking Necessary, againwiththispodcast.com. That's also where you can find links to our very special 90210 book, illustrated by Julie Kane, so browse on over there today. You can also follow us on Twitter at AWT90210 and join our Patreon page at patreon.com/againwiththis. Any level of support gets you extra content. I'm shunned Get Well Orchid Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on Twitter at Tomato Nation. My co-host is Guilt Trip Room Serviced Grilled Cheese Tara Ariano, and she's on Twitter at Tara Ariano. And our producer never forgets to refill the hot sauce. He's David T. Cole. Talk to you next time.